our distinguished panelists, Natan Sharansky, Gil Troy, who need obviously no introduction, except in the sense that they are the co-authors of a superb new essay in the fourth, and I'm very happy to say not final, issue of Sapir called Aspiration. We just got paper copies a few days ago. And Sapir, which is published by the Maimonides Fund, is dedicated to exploring dilemmas in the Jewish world for the sake of proposing ideas for a thriving Jewish future. And this last issue, which we titled Aspiration, is a series of essays in which about 17 very distinguished writers have offered what we call moonshot ideas for transforming Jewish life. So Gil and Natan have offered, I think, one of the most fascinating and I think one of the most pragmatic moonshot ideas. And we're gonna get to that in just a few minutes, but I think, I suspect that I would be remiss as a moderator, given the circumstances of today, of the last few weeks, not to take advantage of Natan to ask him to offer your thoughts about events in Ukraine, about what Vladimir Putin's intentions and state of mind might be, and where we are likely to go from here and maybe where we should go from here. So Natan, maybe you can begin by telling us, do you see Putin as the same man he was 5, 10, or 15 years ago?
Well, of course, that's the same KGB officer with the same, by the way, background, which made him very sympathetic to Jews, and with the same belief that that power is something extremely important and much more important than all these talks about democracy. But Putin, whom I met, and in the first 4 or 5 years of his presidency, I met many times him, he was the one who was eager to get recognition of the world leaders and to accept Russia as a club of superpowers. And for him, it was so important to build bridges with Bush and with Merkel. And by the way, that was one of the reasons why he was interested in meeting me, because he believed that Jewish community will help him to be accepted in the West. Skipping on, 15 years later, that is the person who was for 20 years at power, who believes that all these Bushes and Obamas and Merkels are coming and leaving and disappearing in the oblivion. And he is the leader forever. He is the only really strong leader, not because Russia is the strongest, but he is the one who is ready to use this power. And he has a historical mission. There was the biggest tragedy of the 20th century. He believes and he speaks about it. It was this decay of the Soviet Union. And he believes that it was real criminals, those leaders who permitted to destroy Soviet Union. And now he, with his great heroes are Peter the Great, Ekaterina, Stalin, and now he, who has to recapture, to bring back the Russian lands. And he's very lonely. He, practically nobody in Kremlin knows what is really happening in his world, because of this world, him and history, there is nobody. And that's how he explained some time ago that Ukraine is not the country and Ukrainians are not the people, and the time has come to bring them back to their real place, part of Russian people.
Do you think his ambitions stop with Ukraine or parts of Ukraine,
no, no,
or do they go farther?
His ambition is very big, and he feels the weakness, and he believes that the free world is very weak. And exactly as he started, if you remember Crimea and all this Ukraine, when Obama demonstrated his weakness, now he decided this time, when all the Western world shows that from his point of view, there are no strong leader, definitely nobody who's ready to use their weapons. That is the moment. If he will not be stopped, and the only thing which can stop him is absolute unity of the free world and demonstrating their readiness to use all their power. He will continue, and Ukraine will be not the end. And at least that part of Poland, which was part of Russian Empire, which already Ekaterina the Great got it, and then Stalin got it. And so he now will not get it. That is bad side. The good side is that, first of all, he doesn't see the world as it is. He really believed that Ukrainians will have no resistance, that Ukrainian people really would not, it doesn't matter for them if this government or that government will be removed. They removed so many governments. And he didn't expect that NATO will come back to life, and that there will be such level of unity. But so it's really absolutely important that in the days to come, the free world will speak in one voice and will speak strongly.
Will he escalate? And how seriously do you take this?
I think, look, first of all, nobody knows, because really nobody, I don't think that Shoigu, Minister of Defense, knows, and his advisor, because it's all, first of all, it's happened, decisions are made in the head of Putin. Second, I believe he has to have second thoughts, because he sees that it adds absolutely no popularity to him in Russia, to the contrary. He sees that the resistance of the world is much bigger. I think this boycott, economical boycott, but I would say sports, the fact that he is thrown out, Russia is thrown from all the sports league competitions, for him, that's how he saw the world. That's how he wanted to see always his picture, the Olympic Games, wrestling, participating all the types of sports, and embracing every Russian sportsman who brings the glory to Russia. And for him to see that so easily, he is thrown away just in these hours from all this competition around the world, I think it has to make him to feel that it's not exactly as he wanted. And I think that if, for example, Ukraine would accept surrender at this moment, meaning that it will accept, okay, we recognize that Crimea is yours and Donbass is independent state, at this moment, he probably will drop his idea to bring Ukraine back as a part of Russia, to turn Ukraine into another Belarus.
Let me ask you one final question about
this. But Ukraine is not going to do it. So yes, the confrontation will continue, and the free world has to be very strong, that's all. Yeah.
Let me ask you a final question, which is, what is the wise position for Israel to take? Obviously, I suspect most Israelis are innately sympathetic to the Ukrainian side, but there's a strategic interest in a relationship with Russia.
First of all, the Israelis are extremely sympathetic, and it's new immigrants, already not new immigrants, but all those who came from the former Soviet Union, Russia and Ukraine are extremely supportive of Russia. Just today got a lot of
Russia or Ukraine?
Oh, no, of Ukraine, sorry, of Ukraine. And just today got a lot of telephone calls that we want to start boycott of the Russian things which are sold. Those who used to buy Russian food all the time now want to boycott Russian food and to replace it with Ukrainian food. So it is, on the other hand, the state is extremely cautious. I was in the first hours and days, I am in the minority of almost one who's speaking on TV that we have open and strongly such a clear moral case and taste for the revolt. And I'm explained again and again. And by the way, by very serious people, by top people, how cautious we have to be. Because of the weakness of the West, West gave the keys from the skies in the Middle East to Putin, this base. And because of the weakness of the West gave billions and billions of dollars to Iran to build the military bases. We have to attack these bases every night, and we have to do it with the agreement of Putin. And that's real catch for Israel. But I believe that the level of our confrontation between the free world and dictatorship is so high that we have to put everything aside, and yes, to take very openly position, not only in the United Nations, but there will be also the question, if Israel is part of these sanctions, or is it undermining these sanctions? So I think that's the decision which I know what our leaders want to say. I know why they're afraid. I hope that in the end, Israel has no choice. It has to be part of the free world's battle against this threat.
Listen, thank you so much. But this is I think everyone appreciated this. I do want to turn to what I think is a really important essay that the two of you wrote, a gap year for your Jewish teen. And maybe Gil, let me start with you. The great question really that I think people have is, and I think this is true with all of these ideas, which in some ways you say, well, that seems kind of obvious, is there are programs already in existence that offer gap years for Jewish teens between high school and college, bring them to Israel. They, from all accounts, I know one person who did it, they do a great job. So why hasn't this taken off in the way that, say, Birthright did?
First of all, it's a pleasure to be with you, and I want to honor all the great work you're doing with the Sapir Journal. It's really been amazing to see how it's just moved the needle on so many conversations, and we're honored to be a part of this conversation, both in terms of the big moonshot ideas. What are the ideas we need to change the Jewish world, and specifically this initiative to try to get more young Jews going to Israel for a significant amount of time, basically as a follow-up to the Birthright idea? And we kind of use two models. One is we see what's happened in Israel with what's called the Mechina programs, the pre-army programs. And once upon a time, the notion of an Israeli young person who's already giving 2, 3, 4, 5 years of service, taking another year seemed insane. And yet more and more we've seen, especially in neighborhoods with young people who are idealistic, who are motivated, they feel that when they take that extra year, they benefit and the state benefits. The state, the army has done the math, 18 plus one is 19, and they realize how much more mature these people are, how much more motivated they are. And before you plunge into the army, to take an opportunity to learn a little bit about yourself is so important. So that's one model. And the second model, frankly, is the Orthodox world. We've seen how in the American Orthodox world, going to Israel for a year has become just so standard that if you don't go, the question is, why aren't you going? And that's what we're trying to achieve with the 80% of the American Jewish community that isn't religious. And indeed, there are some excellent programs. But what's the biggest obstacle? And here, I don't want to get too political, but we basically riffed off a famous joke in Washington where people say, what's the most dangerous place in Washington? It's the place between Chuck Schumer and a photographer. So we say, what's the most dangerous place in the American Jewish community to stand somehow between the American Jewish student and the American Jewish parent and the American Jewish grandparent and college? And we see this worship of the university. And it's particularly ironic at this point, where it's not only a little bit disturbing that our community has become so careerist and so materialistic, we'll talk about that in group therapy later, but also precisely at this moment, when so many universities, especially elite universities, have ideologically turned against some of the core Jewish values that made the American Jewish community so successful, that makes Israel so successful, we say, what's going on here? And we know that there have been some calls to redo the American university. That's for a broader conversation that's way outside our wheelhouse. But we said, wouldn't we see amazing change in the American Jewish community and frankly, in the Israel diaspora conversation, if we could at least take that same success in the Mechina programs and the Yeshiva programs and transfer it to the American Jewish world, to Canada, to the UK, to Australia, to France, to get young Jews understanding that is part of their rite of passage. You finish high school, and before you go to college, you take a year. It could be a year of service. It could be a year on a more ideological program. It could be a year in yeshiva. And we're adding, it could also just be an academic year. We also learn a little bit about critical thinking about liberal arts.
So what obviously makes the passage from the United States or North America, let's say, to Israel relatively easy for Orthodox teenagers is that most of them have a fairly good command of Hebrew. Their ties to Israel are usually strong. It's part of everyday conversation. They are not incidentally Jews. They are centrally Jews, speaking, you know, generally speaking. That is not quite the same with a lot of the more secular Jewish community, where they might be proud of being Jewish. They have had a bar bat mitzvah, but it hasn't been that much of a part of their life. Israel is several thousand miles away. Every now and then there's a war that scares people, particularly scares parents. So how do you begin, Natan, to reach that segment of the population to convince them that this is something that, you know, they ought to do?
Well, first of all, yes, the difference of our project from all the previous, Birthrights and Masa, there it was clear that the idea was to strengthen Jewish identity. We want to make you are interested to discover what the Jewish identity means. You're interested to connect yourself better to the history and the story of Jewish people. Here, Israel experiences are very good. There is limited number of people who are interested on their way to the Ivy League to lose even 1 week, and not speaking about 1 year. We are speaking about those you want to succeed in the university. At the same time, you parents want that your child will not be less proud of being part of Jewish family because they can be so easily brainwashed there. So we want to propose you a year in Israel in good universities who prepare special courses in English, who these courses will be introduced by the best specialists, by the best professors who also are teaching in Harvard and other places. There will be a number of courses which at the same time will be, how to say, counted or whatever, accepted in the Ivy League. So it saves you time and energy from your future efforts. And at the same time, you'll know much better the story of your people, which will be challenged when you go to the university. So important thing is here, the efforts which have to be done on Israel's side, first of all, to prepare, to encourage, to help to our universities, to help this, to have all these sources, not that they will feel like they are in the best American university, and at the same time, they have this, all these interesting Israeli engaging programs.
And let me ask you, Gil.
From Israel, and then we move it there, yeah.
I mean, obviously you tell me, but if this were to come to fruition, fully to fruition in 10 years, you would have hundreds of thousands or at least tens of thousands of young Jewish teens spending this year in Israel. But who is it that you want to attract at first? And what is the sales pitch to that kid who just got into, let's say, University of Pennsylvania or Stanford or Johns Hopkins or one of the elite schools, and you want to sort of intercede with them? How do you foster the perception that this is not a common experience but actually an elite experience?
So as Natan was saying, part of it is
and by the way, just let me interrupt. In about 20 minutes, just this is for the audience, we will open this up to questions, but it's not too soon to start populating the chat function or the Q&A screen with your questions as they occur to you. So please feel free to do it, and I'll try to call on as many people as possible. Sorry for the interruption, Gil.
So the slogan would be, this isn't a year off, but this is a year on. The slogan, the pitch would be that this is not an opportunity to run away from your studies, because if you want to do that, there are lots of existing programs, but we need to build a series of programs. Like one idea we had was take over a beautiful old house and put in, and this is actually built on a wonderful scholarship that they have in McGill University, a fellowship for people in their 20s. And they put 30 young people in the house and they have the run of McGill University. So here you put them in a house in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv, call them Tel Aviv fellows or Jerusalem fellows, make it a very elite program and give them an opportunity to put together their own academic program. And the idea would be, first of all, take advantage of the current crisis in the university. So many people are realizing, and we've seen in the last year and a half, a greater realization of this problem in the university, whether you're from the left or from the right, it doesn't matter, that too many universities have been hijacked by a very particular agenda. Too many universities have gone away from liberal arts. Too many universities are not teaching critical thinking. And so what we're trying to say is let's build a series of programs that not only teach about Judaism and Zionism and human values, but also teach about critical thought, teach about liberal arts. And so then you go to the university, and that's why we're calling it a prep year, extra prepared with a lens on the world that allows you to sift through when you're being propagandized and to sift through when you're actually learning something. So
let me ask, build on that, because I think it's a fascinating idea. Of course, it could be the basis of a very interesting reality TV show, but right. 30 19-year-old Jewish teens in a nice mansion. But what you're suggesting is a kind of elite experience. And I think in your essay somewhere, Natan, you mentioned the idea of a kind of a Rhodes scholarship for Jewish teens, which at least gets you in the way, maybe not the name Rhodes itself, you'd have to find maybe a different name for it. But people, I think, get more or less get the idea. Birthright, when it began, sorry, I think my dog may be barking in the back. Birthright, when it began, required an admissions. I mean, it was not, the idea was that you were not supposed to feel like any old person or any young person could do this. In fact, you were fortunate to be selected. Would this kind of also be part of the strategy of turning what is supposed to be a mass experience actually into at least the sense of an elite experience?
Well, I don't think it will happen from the beginning. Again, if I take the experience of pre-military academies, and I happened to be in the beginning when this idea was born, and the idea was really to strengthen then in the beginning, it was young Jews who want to have a military career, but parents are afraid that they will lose their religiosity, they will become secular. And so in the beginning, there were those who took this risk, not knowing what will be the result. But already, let's say, in 2 years, the army was very interested to pay for this, and competition started. And I don't think that in the first year there was no real competition. You had really to choose people who will agree to send their children for this experiment. Already on the third year, there were much more candidates than the places. And today, of course, there is a big competition on all this. So in this case, I'm not sure that it will happen very quickly. Look, elitist programs can be created. And for example, in Masa or in Birthright, we have a special elitist program for very talented kids, which costs more money for the state or for the Jewish community, but which really are very successful. But it's for a small number of people, for 5% or 2% of all the people. In this case, if our project will be successful, and there are, like, let's say, 90,000 of young Jewish kids who every year go to the universities. We want that in the end, at least 10,000 will go. So you have to start from the first few hundreds and then very quickly move to thousands. I believe that you will have really to use propaganda, a lot of publicity in the beginning, but if it is built right, already 2 years after this, there will be many more those who desire to do it, but Gil, maybe you have more experience with this.
Let me ask you one aspect of this, which has always intrigued me. Natan, you would know something about this, so would you, Gil. It's the question of the involvement of the Israeli government. And the Israeli government, or frankly, any government, is always a mixed blessing. So for a variety of reasons. So Gil, what would you envision should be the proper role of the government in sponsoring this, or should it just stay out of the way? Should this be a purely private philanthropic effort?
Well, based on Natan's experience, he was very helpful in that part of writing the article, because he's seen many of the obstacles right now that the Israeli government sometimes puts up, even without thinking about it, emphasizing so much that the language of instruction has to be in Hebrew, and a Zionist role for that. But for a gap year program, you want to be able to have English courses. You want to be able to have, so you want to make sure that the university authorities in Israel aren't creating obstacles when the universities try to initiate English language programs. So there's lots to be done in terms of making the universities, which in Israel are far more intertwined with the government than they are in the US, more responsive and more user-friendly. But I think what we really have to do is take a step back and say, how do we do this, right? So I disagree. I actually think that you could start very, very quickly with one elite kind of program, with a Rhodes Scholarship type program. I don't think it's very hard to do a kind of, you know, bit of a academic beauty contest to really invest a lot in getting those 30 or 40 for a year. But the beautiful thing about this program would be, unlike so many other programs, when you get rejected from that program, you go to another program. So the key would be to try to get as large a pool of applicants as possible. And first you put your resources in one particular program, which is going to be your flagship program. Because again, we're trying to build up the academic elite side, well aware that there are many other initiatives that are dealing with other parts of the Israel experience. At the same time, you bring in government money to help beef up the publicity, the advertising for the existing programs. And you bring in consultants to say, okay, what's missing? How can we improve things? So I think it has to be a much more systemic thing. I think the government can lead without branding every program as a government program. I think the government can bring resources, can bring, in the same way that, you know, Birthright is not considered to be an Israeli government initiative, but there's obviously been a lot of work with the government over the years. And so I think it has to be kind of a public-private venture.
So this was a point that...
Let me say that the point... And both in the case of Birthrights and of course Maasai even more, the government is paying its share for the Birthright. Here, I really believe that the government, as Gil said, the government should be involved in modernizing universities, educational programs. It should not be involved in convincing young people to come, in paying for their education, and other things. Our government is naturally interested that universities will become the universities of all the Jewish people, or universities are interested. Universities warn me that with all their enthusiasm, they see a lot of problems with the bureaucracy in the government. So this is exactly what we have to deal with Israel, to overcome all these bureaucratic problems and to help the universities to propose the variety of opportunities. The rest.
One of the issues that you raise, and I think it would be useful if you addressed it here out loud, is, you know, I mean, there was resistance to Birthright, I think, from the government at the very beginning until they realized its value. But the value of Birthright ultimately rests in the fact that it strengthens the connection of the diaspora and young diaspora Jews to Israel. What you're proposing is a little bit different. Which is that you are essentially offering a credential for American students who are then going to go back to Penn or Stanford or Hopkins and live their lives, right? So I mean, I think this is maybe the strong objection to your argument, and I'd like just to hear you, maybe Gil, address that objection.
Look, I've been very involved in Birthright as the chair of the Education Committee in a lay capacity. And as much as we invest in the educational process, as important as it is that we have the best educational experiences possible and touring experiences for the participants, we're well aware that the power of Birthright and the magic of Birthright is the power of Israel and the magic of Israel. And so once you bring people over, they could be studying farming, or they could be studying engineering, or they could be studying philosophy, or they could be studying Jewish thought. The star of the show is the background. The star of the show is Israel. The star of the show is the Chagim and the Shabbat and the people who meet you on the street and greet you on the street, and make you feel like you're a part of a family. The star of the show is the excitement of being part of Jewish history. The star of the show is understanding that Judaism isn't just something you do three times a year in a synagogue on the 2 days of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and it's so intimidating and so dry that it takes you a whole year to screw up the courage to come back. But it's something that's 24/7, 365 days a year, that it's in your blood. So that's the ultimate. We're very explicit in the article, the Zionist agenda behind it. But let's think of just two very interesting moments. One, a young 15-year-old, 16-year-old walks into any house, his grandparents' house, her parents' house, her friend's house, his rabbi's house. The first question they're asked is, what do you want to be when you grow up? And connected to that is, where are you going to college? If the question all of a sudden was, what program are you going to do in Israel? Are you going to do service? Are you going to be on a kibbutz? Are you going to go to one of these elite programs? All of a sudden, the dynamics would start changing. It's so easy to say, the young people are abandoning us. I'm looking at the old people. I'm saying, what's the messaging that's coming from Federation, from rabbis, from parents, from grandparents? Is this seen as central? And connected to that is, I know, even let's look at the most engaged Jews. I know in the synagogue that I was in Montreal, when the young people went off to March of the Living, the 15 and 16 year olds, before they went, they were honored in the synagogue. When they came back, everyone gave a 5-minute talk about what they saw at Auschwitz. If you go off to Israel for a year, you're not honored before you go, and nobody wants to hear you when you come back. So even in the holy of holies of American Jewry, outside of the Orthodox world, the messaging isn't that this is important. The messaging isn't that this is central. And so, you want to have an advertising campaign, you want to have excellent programming, but the first thing that has to happen before we even start working with our young people is, among the leadership and among the lay people, there has to be a shift that this has to be seen as central, as life-changing, and frankly, as a lifeline for the diaspora communities.
Let me ask you.
If I understand correctly, Brett was also asking why the government will be interested. And I have to say, if it was 20 years ago, there was absolutely, but we were trying to convince the government why birthrights is in the interest of Israel, it would be absolutely impossible to say that to pay or to spend any efforts in order parents can send their kids to study and then go back to Harvard and not to make Aliyah. Of course, it would be absolutely impossible. But since then, Israeli government step by step discovered that there is such a thing as a new anti-Semitism, and that this hatred to Israel is influencing very much on the young generation, and importance of connecting between hating of Israel and hating of Jews is very important. And Israel government was ready to finance a lot of programs how to influence on the atmosphere in the American universities for the Jews. So it became a big problem for the Jews in their communities, but also Israel realizes that that's their problem. And when we were many times as the head of Jewish agency, we were reporting to the government about what we are doing to help to young Jews in the American universities to stand against this anti-Zionist propaganda. It seemed very important for enemies, because our problem, yes, it's our idea. It is helping them to be in Ivy League to have their career, but at the same time, to be protected from this anti-Israeli propaganda and to feel much more confident as Jews when they're coming to American universities. Today, we can find a lot of understanding or a lot of politicians who understand why it is also important for Israel.
One additional question before we turn to our audience, and I think I'm seeing a lot of good questions, is the role of industry. Because one thing that strikes me as a gimme, so to speak, is that Israel is now a world leader in industries that are popular with young people and lead to highly remunerative careers in throughout the United States. So does that also have a place in terms of internships, work opportunities for a gap year in Israel? I mean, could you take a gap if you're an 18-year-old who, you know, has mediocre grades in history and not a lot of interest in religion or Jewish life, but you're a coder? Heading to Israel might be, in fact, a very interesting opportunity if those opportunities are there. So what is your thinking on that dimension of the program, Gil?
Certainly, we mentioned that in the article. The it's essential, first of all, that those students who, let's say, just want to, even if they're STEM-oriented, you know, scientific-oriented, computer-oriented, want to do a humanities year, that they keep that muscle strong. So part of it is you have to make sure that many of those programs offer learning in that. But in terms of internships, we have excellent examples of this. Birthright has been running this program called Birthright Excel, which gets hundreds of applications every year from the best students. And I actually have the privilege of meeting with them once a year and talking ideology with them. And it's a mix of Birthright alumni and young Israelis who live together and have common experiences together during the summer while they're interning at Google and Bloomberg and all the top firms. And, you know, we know that there's a whole conversation going on in the startup world of, do you need a university degree or not? So I think there'd be a lot of openness to even 18 and 19 and 20 year olds coming for 6 months, for a year, to have that experience. And again, what would be the excitement? They're living in Jewish space. They're living in Jewish time. Maybe they're learning a little bit of Hebrew. Obviously in the high-tech industry, the lingua franca is English, so they'd have an easy way in. They wouldn't have the language barrier that you were mentioning before. So I think, and then when you talk about what the government's looking for, we know that there are estimates of as many as 15,000 job opportunities go missing every year because the Israeli startup nation wants to grow, but there just aren't enough people ready to do it. So this would be a win-win for everybody.
Let's turn to some of the questions that we have from our audience. I'm always eager to give them more and more time. And we have some very good questions. Let me start with one from Abby Schachter, who says, as someone who did a gap year between high school and college at Hebrew University, I strongly endorse the idea, but I see several problems. Number one, US colleges can be hugely stingy about accepting others' credits, so you have to argue that an extra year of your education isn't going to hurt you. Number two, the curriculum at Hebrew University for the overseas students was not geared toward raising the Jewish consciousness of the, was not raising to, toward raising their Jewish consciousness. How do you get established programs to take up your idea? Natan?
Well, first of all, universities are very interested. I spoke with a number of the presidents, the leaders of Israeli universities. They're really very interested to become the universities for Jewish people. Second, yes, they will have to make a lot of adjustments and agreements with the American universities. Just at this moment, we have Tel Aviv University, who has a special program together with Columbia University. So 1 year here, and then you continue there. They just recently signed agreement with Rutgers University. Yes, in order to succeed this project, we need, first of all, to make sure that the government helps to the universities and the universities develop a number of programs which are recognized, by which are already in partnership or in one or another form are coordinated with the universities in America. No doubt that in today's atmosphere of almost attempts to boycott Israel in different forms, there can be resistance at some universities. Nevertheless, even today, we have a number of successful cooperations between universities in America and Israel. And yes, that's something that has to be worked on. And I believe there is a lot of interest and goodwill on all sides.
If I could just add two very specific ideas here. One is, I think so many Jewish academics don't want to be involved in the fight over Zionism and anti-Zionism and BDS. If you approach them, professors, administrators, and say, I'm approaching you as an educator. I simply want you to be a bridge builder between the community and your university to help make this happen, to educate people and not to propagandize. I think there are lots of people who'd be very happy to do it. I think there's a lot more goodwill out there. There are a lot more professors whom I know personally who had life-changing Year in Israel programs, but simply don't want to be a big mouth like me and get involved in the fight for Israel, but they're very happy to be involved in Jewish life and building bridges. That's number one. Number two is, I completely agree, Avi, by the way, hi, with the critique of some of the Israel programs. For example, when you have a Hebrew University program or Tel Aviv University program, I'm not picking on any one of them, do you make sure that they have a Seder to go to? Do you make sure that they have Rosh Hashanah plans? I think that no matter how elite the educational experience is, I think we also have to think about, how do you make it a positive Jewish experience? How do you make it a consciousness raising experience? How do you guide these young people so that they have the opportunity to also taste a little bit of a different form of Jewish life, a different kind of Jewish identity? I'd also say, you know, if this really works, you have a massive camp at the beginning of the year and at the end of the year to framework the experience, to frame the experience. And there you do it by location, so that all the kids who are going to be studying at Penn or Stanford or Chicago or Rutgers can meet together at the beginning of the year, at the end of the year, or all the kids from Toronto or Montreal or New York can meet together. And then you're starting to build community, and then you're already building in a sense of follow-up and a sense of camaraderie.
Let me, a question from Tabia or Tabia Lee. How can these programs be promoted and marketed to attract more progressive leaning Jewish students and to provide them with the grounding and support they need to become educated and proud of their identities and powerful advocates for Jewish inclusion when they return to their campuses after the experience? Natan, do you want to take that one?
Well, first of all, we don't have the lack of progressive courses and progressive experiences in Israeli universities. Second, one thing is to read about the problems which, let's say, non-Orthodox Jews are facing Israel. And the other thing is to come and to live here and to be active in your non-Orthodox movement or with the groups of progressives or with the groups of those who are trying to build bridges with the Palestinians on the left or with the settlers on the right. Israel is so full of all the different ideologies, and this feeling that in fact it is closed for the people of one disappears very quickly when you live inside of this, when you participate in the debate. And Israeli universities are full of debate and full of life for different groups of Israeli society.
Moshe Pripstein asks a question, which I think has to be asked for you, Natan. He says, a naive question, is there anything to be learned from the old refusnik movement tactics in galvanizing support and interest from the Jewish youth?
Well, Moshe Pripstein is one of the leaders of the struggle for Soviet Jewry in mobilizing scientific community in the United States of America. If I'm not sure that he was living in San Francisco and was part of Stanford University. So probably the same Moshe. So if yes, I welcome.
How many Moshes can there be?
Yeah, exactly. But no, look, we can learn a lot from struggle for Soviet Jewry and for that unifying platform which it presented. But there is no way to use it automatically. the level of polarization among Jewish people and the difficulties which you have to convince that people, for example, people on the left have to fight with the anti-Semitism on the left, and people on the right have to fight with the anti-Semitism on the right, and not to fight one another. It's difficult. Soviet Jewry, because was from this point, was the great gift of God to Jewish people. I don't think that God will be giving us such gifts every 10 years. So we have to find other ways to unite our efforts.
Stephen Flatow says, it's a comment, but maybe Gil, you can respond. He writes, this is a heartbreaking conversation. When my family had the Elisa Flatow Scholarship Fund, we were able to subsidize 5 to 8 students to study in Israel. All in all, they funded 150 kids. We ultimately failed because the non-Orthodox movements were not interested in sending kids to Israel, and it was impossible for us to fundraise because the beneficiaries of our program were by and large middle-class families. Gil, do you want to just address Stephen's comment?
Sure. Well, first of all, Stephen is a hero of the Jewish people who's fought so hard against terrorism on so many fronts and has been so generous in so many ways. And yes, look, I looked at this a few years ago. I was doing some consulting for the excellent Young Judea Year Course program. And I was shocked that the number of students that year on a gap year program who were not religious was about 700 out of a potential pool of 90,000. So we have nowhere to go but up. And I agree with you, Stephen, that it is heartbreaking because, and as I said, the rot starts from the top. Our federations, our rabbis, our teachers, our parents, our grandparents have not invested in this idea. So when you tried that wonderful initiative, you were really spitting in the wind because the winds were all about, what college are you going to? Put this Israel nonsense aside. And then all of a sudden, they get to college and they either are involved in the political struggle or they're simply having their own existential struggle. And the parents start yelling and screaming at me when I arrive on campus and in the community going, what's wrong with our kids? And I say, what's wrong with the parents? So we really, this has to be a much more systematic kind of conversation, a much more systematic change within the Jewish community of what are the values? What is the messaging? I go to Jewish day schools and I'm surprised, frankly, at so many of them are so pivoting around the college experience. They're so careerist. And when I talk to the young people about values, about getting outside the materialist box, about things being more important than your GPA or your CV, I can see that rarely has an adult come and spoke to them that way. And so that's the deeper issue here. Until we do that, and then until we free ourselves, and this goes also to the progressive issue, from looking at Israel only in the Israel advocacy vein, and this has been one of the great successes of Birthright, and seeing it as an identity journey, seeing it as a historical journey, seeing it as part of our heritage, no matter who you are, right, left, religious, non-religious, and seeing it as both a real life place with all its complexities, but also a tool that can help us understand the dimensionality and richness of the Jewish experience, it's not going to work. So this is you know, we have to work on program, we have to work on credits, we have to work on Israel and, you know, and the Israeli government, but we also have to go deeper into an ideological conversation about who are our kids and who are we and what are we raising them to be and what do we want them to be. And then I'll just add one more thing. When we add this current crisis, in America right now, where you seem like you can't really have a conversation from the right or from the left without being accused of betraying, you know, fundamentals. When we think about what was the key to the success of the American Jewish community, it was merit. It was putting identity aside. It was focusing on essence and substance. That also has to be the messaging, a true lowercase L liberalism. That has to be the messaging and substance of some of our Israel programs.
A question from Peter Eckstein, which Gil touched on briefly, but maybe I'll put this to Natan. Should a significant component of the year be based on some form of service, some volunteerism? This would make them feel part of something bigger than themselves that they've contributed to and bring back that spirit of duty and responsibility to their community. So what do you say to that, Natan?
Well, I'd like it to be, but I don't think that we should limit only to those who are interested or who are ready for volunteer work. We really want to reach those masses or those many young Jews who are is that first of all, their career. And at the same time, they are not indifferent to their Jewishness, but not enthusiastic enough to start working and volunteering and so on. So I would say there must be enough place for both. Those who want, it is easy to create for them these opportunities because there are so many programs in Israel which are based on this volunteerism. But those who are not ready, who don't want to lose time in building their career, there must be also a place for them.
A question from Baruch Friedman Cole. Gil, I'll put this to you. How do you propose to deal with university students or rabbinical students who come to Israel and become significant critics of Israeli policies regarding Arab Israelis and Palestinians?
So look, this is where I ultimately have faith in the experience and have faith in our community. The last thing I want is to create a propaganda machine. The last thing I want is to create a series of do's and don'ts and how to think and how not to think. But I truly believe in what I call Pilates, Pilates Zionism, Pilates Judaism. The more we build up the core.
You're referring to the stomach exercises.
Yes, the more we build up our core strength, the more we build up our sense of who we are as a people, the more we'll be able to sustain conversations that are difficult and critical about what Israel does wrong, because we'll also see what Israel does right. The biggest problem today on campus is not that people sometimes criticize Israel. The problem is that they go from criticizing Israel to demonizing Israel, to delegitimizing Israel, to attacking Israel in a disproportionate way. And yes, I'm using Natan's 3Ds on purpose. And so I believe that the issue, and frankly, I think this has been the issue in the rabbinic student, among some of the rabbinic communities too, that you think the way to deal with Israel and the way to really be engaged is through Israel advocacy. And it's a failure on the right too. That the right says, okay, well, that's, you know, we need to be, on the front lines in the struggle for Israel. And the left says we have to be in the struggle against the occupation. And that's a piece of the Israel experience. When you come here for a year, most people, when you come here and have a more integrated experience, you see that that's one part of Israel, but it doesn't define us. Our enemies want to define Israel only as the central headache of the Jewish people. They have what I call the occupation preoccupation and only want to see Israel through the lens of the Palestinians. That was Yasser Arafat's great conceit. We have to see Israel through the Jewish lens and through an American lens and through a multidimensional lens. And then I believe that we won't have a problem of people turning on us. Instead, we'll have people who have a range of opinions and a range of experiences, but understand how central Israel is to the Jewish experience and to modern Jewish identity.
There's a comment here that it's, I'd like to have you comment on briefly, just because I'm looking at the clock, but Adina Friedman, I think, has been very involved in programs like these for years. Thank you for your thoughtful article. If gap year programs only arm people with propaganda and pro-Israel rhetoric, we will have missed the boat. One of the opportunities made possible by an extended stay in Israel is the chance to engage with a real Israel and to develop an authentic and personal perspective, which you, both of you, have been talking about. Gap year programs ought to be scaffolded in an intentional way to help young adults thoughtfully and carefully engage critically with an authentic Israel. How do you think we can go about doing this in a scaled up gap year experience? So maybe you've addressed that in some ways, but let's talk about the scaled up side of that question. Natan?
Well, I in order to understand what it means, scaled up, maybe I will listen to Gil and then we'll join.
Gil, do you want to offer a thought here?
Yeah, so look, in our article, we were very much focusing on what's the problem. The problem is this, you know, ideological attack on American universities and the growing gap between American Jews and Israeli Jews. What's a solution? The more elitist approach. But if we take a step back and we think about Israel programs, let's think of four different streams. We think of service. We think of ideological programs like the Young Judea program that Adina Friedman of Young Judea is so involved with. We think of an academic program, and we can think of the yeshiva program. And if we look at those four streams and we say, first of all, some programs should mix various things in the components in the recipe, and some of them should emphasize one of those four, then we can start, and then through Masa, and other existing structures. We can create a website so you can go on and you can find what works for you. We can start scaling up because we can start showing that it's not just one thing. It's not just one way. It's not a silver bullet. It's not, you know, just like Birthright started originally as one 10-day formula. Now you can go on a Birthright trip and it can be through cooking and it can be as an LGBTQ person. It can be as a hiker, a biker. There, we customize because that's what our young people are looking for these days. So I think we can do a similar thing with the Israel experience, but we have to start somewhere. And we have to start on the ground with better programming and more effective programming, more modern programming. We have to start in the air with a different approach to Israel, to Zionism, to education, and to higher education.
Okay, I only want to add that, look, after all, these programs, the difference of this program from many others, that first of all, we try to target those who are interested in their career, in their academical, whatever, professional career, and because they are ready to pay, or their parents are ready to pay for this. And thanks God in Israel, they will have to pay less, but nevertheless, than in Harvard, and at the same time, to have a very good education preparing them for Harvard. That will be the reason why they'll be interested in proposals of different Israeli universities, who hopefully will be also competing with their proposal. And then we believe that while they decide to spend a year in Israel and universities will propose them in interesting, but time taking a lot of effort and energy programs to study, Israel in a very natural way will add to their dialogue. And from my experience, people who are coming with the left-wing convictions continue to be left-wing, and people who are coming with the right-wing continue and even deepen their right-wing conviction. And the people who are religious will be even more passionate religious and secular. So, but they will be strengthened in their beliefs, because they always will find also interested people who think the same in Israel, but will do it as part of dialogue with Israeli society and part of being proud of belonging to these people. And that is the idea.
There's so many great questions and it pains me not to get to them. I'm just going to read, it's a question, but I'm just going to take it as a statement from Ron Leibowitz and then one final question. Ron asks, how do you reach young Jews or their parents with these possible experiences at Israeli universities sooner, way before their senior year of high school? I ask because the rise of social media as organized at elite universities is now so effective in forming very strong social groups as soon as they're accepted early action. High school seniors are now drawn so effectively to their classmates to be so too many forget about gap year opportunities. Educating about ideas in Israel must begin sooner, which I can see is problematic, more pressure, but how else do you counter the impact of social media? I'm gonna ask you not to answer that, but I wanted to read it out loud because I think it's really a stupendous question. And then one final practical question, maybe we can close on this, Gil, to you, from Eric Fleiss. Says he's very active in pro-Israel and Jewish causes and he has four kids, the oldest at 15. And yet I didn't know there were any resources for time in Israel besides Birthright. Where can I find what's available today to sell to my cynical teenager, let alone if this idea takes root? Any quick tips for Eric?
Yeah, I would start with Masa. I would start with the Jewish Agency, and I also challenge my synagogue. If your Jewish day school isn't providing those resources, they're failing. In the same way that every grandparent that I know opens a college fund for their kids, for their grandkids when they're born, we have to start thinking of the Jewish Year in Israel Fund, not just in terms of money, but in terms of ideology. And yes, I completely relate to your question that the Jewish community itself isn't providing the resources, the coordination, but also just, you know, Google Year in Israel program, you'll find Young Judea, you'll find Hartman, you'll find Kivunim, all kinds of wonderful, wonderful programs.
I wish we could go on further, and I want to apologize to those of you in the audience whose questions I didn't get to, but you can see that this is generating you know, real excitement and real interest, and which is why I'm so grateful to the two of you, Gil and Natan, for offering what I thought was a stupendous contribution to our fourth issue. I hope there are not just interested parents and maybe a few cynical teenagers, but philanthropists and leaders in the Jewish community who are going to think about this very seriously, because I think this is the kind of idea that is transformative for the long term. And those are the sort of solutions that I think everyone on this conversation is looking for. So the essay is in the fourth issue of Sapir, sapirjournal.org. We're honored to have you, Gil. We're honored to have you, Natan. And we look forward to further conversations like this. Thanks for listening in.
Well, thank you.
Have a lovely day. Have a lovely evening.
Thank you, Brett, for your leadership.
Thank you.